Simpson in this session. Our Judge Edward Davis. Judge Davis was born in Idaho and came to Alaska in 1939 after graduating from college and law school in Idaho. He's been in Alaska the longest of anyone on the panel, and he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention and one of the draftsmen of the Constitution. Judge Davis was in private practice in Alaska for 20 years and then went on the bench, became a Superior Court judge in 1959 when we attained statehood. He retired from the Superior Court bench in 1973, but we're not sure that date. It's very hard to remember when a judge retired from the Superior Court bench when he keeps working, which Judge Davis has. He's continued to hear cases since then. Justice J.A. Rabinowitz was born in Philadelphia, received his law degree from Harvard Law School in 1952, came to Alaska, had experience in private practice of law and in various public positions, and became a Superior Court judge for the 4th Judicial District in Fairbanks shortly after statehood in 1960. After 5 years on the Superior Court bench, he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Alaska, where he served since 1965, and he was Chief Justice from 1972 to 1975. Art Hippler, to my left, is an Associate Professor of Anthropology at the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and his doctorate is from the University of California at Berkeley. He is the founder and the state president of the Alaska affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union. And he has published papers with Steve Kahn on the systems we have in Alaska providing judicial services and providing resolution of disputes in the rural areas of the state. Together with Steve Kahn, Dr. Hippler is responsible for the initiation of conciliation boards, a type of procedure which he will probably discuss to some extent this morning in the rural areas where it's hard to provide judicial services. Millard Ingram is substituting, Peter Ashenbrenner is substituting for Barry Jackson. Barry got sick and asked Peter to substitute for him, and we're fortunate to have him. Peter Ashenbrenner graduated from law school at Berkeley in 1971, has practiced in Alaska since 1972, serves part-time on the bench as United States Magistrate for Fairbanks, and has done some scholarly work in the area of comparative law, the continental system of law, as well as the common law system. Millard Ingram graduated from Columbia College in 1955, Colorado Law School in 1958, University of Colorado, and came to Alaska in 1961. He was admitted to the bar in 1962 and has been in the private practice of law since. He was the president of the Alaska Bar Association during the 1970-71 term, I believe. And Millard has the distinction among the panelists and among most lawyers in the state of never having lived on a public payroll. With that, I'd like to begin with Judge Davis, who as a delegate to the convention will discuss what the provisions of the judiciary article are, as well as some of the pre-statehood background and the transition to statehood. Judge Davis.
Thank you, Andy. I'd like to commence by going back to what the Alaska Judiciary was at the time of the Constitutional Convention met, and until, of course, sometime after Alaska became a state. We had what we used to call the old judicial divisions. And that is a rather queer term, to say the least, because goodness only knows in Alaska we're divided enough without dividing ourselves by calling ourselves divisions. But in those days, we had, in the first division, we had a judge. That was the southeast area, the Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka area. We had, in the second division, which was Nome, Kotzebue, everything north and west of there, and in fact a good deal east of there, we had a judge. In the so-called third division, Anchorage, Cordova, Valdez, Seward, everything south and west of there for roughly 1,500 miles, we had a judge. Lastly, in the so-called fourth division, Fairbanks, Big Delta, everything north and east of Fairbanks and considerably west of Fairbanks, we had a judge. These judges were appointed by the President of the United States, and they were appointed for specific terms. They, of course, were political appointments. The judges, in many cases, I would think probably even most cases, were people who had no contact with Alaska at all prior to the time that they went on the bench. They were appointed for political purposes. And that's not all bad, because we had some good judges under that system. We had some bad ones, too. All right, that was the setup that existed at the time the Constitutional Convention met here in Fairbanks in college in November of 1955. You will notice in the judicial article that the article itself covers something considerably less than three pages. By coincidence, you'll notice that in Dick Fisher's very excellent book on the Baptist Constitutional Convention, the judicial article is covered once again in roughly three pages, I think just a little bit less. And you will notice that here this morning we have maybe a dozen people. So I think we can assume that the judiciary is something that people don't get too excited about in Alaska. That isn't to say it isn't important. It's one of the three co-equal branches of the Alaska state government. But it's something that generally people don't get too excited about unless we have some either very bad judge who is creating a lot of static, or maybe some particularly good judge is creating a lot of static. But generally speaking, the judicial branch goes about its business and takes care of its business without a great deal of intervention. I know when was a kid in Idaho, I had court sessions only, maybe once or twice a year, and they were district judge court of arrangement. The judge covered several counties. But people did quite often go to court when court was in town. I noticed in my experience on the bench of some almost 17 years now, that we very rarely have anybody in the courtroom watching what is going on. Now, I realize that over the years we have had people that call themselves court watchers that purported to try to keep the courts in line, and that usually meant trying to see that everybody that was brought up before the court on a criminal charge was sentenced to 10 years in the clink without any hope of parole or pardon, probation. But generally speaking, outside of a few things that catch the people's attention, there aren't too many people that are watching the day-to-day work of the court. Now, I'm talking here to another one of our Superior Court judges, incidentally, another one of our Constitutional Convention delegates, and I'm sure that he would, I think he probably would bear me out, that there's rarely a day in court where there's anybody there except the participants and the judge, and of course the court reporter, the girl who takes the matters on the tape. That isn't to say that the courts aren't serious, and if they aren't serious business, they are. But I think generally speaking, people must be fairly well satisfied with the way the courts are working. And if they're not satisfied, generally it is on the criminal area with people who have an axe to grind on the so-called law and order problem. And let me just break it a minute at that point. You know, when a judge is sentencing somebody for a violation of the law, the judge tries to get all the information he can get concerning the particular offense and concerning the particular offender. But really, we don't get everything that we need, no matter how hard we try. And sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we should incarcerate a man for much more time than we do. Maybe we would incarcerate him for much more time if we knew more about him. I suspect we err on the other side. I suspect sometimes we get an impression of a man and think here's a man that ought to spend considerable time in jail, prison, a man who maybe is not a bit worse than the man we put on probation over here because something appears to us that maybe isn't really the fact. Let me move back then. The Constitution, I said a bit ago on the judicial branch, covered approximately 3 pages. I noticed in looking over the Bill of Rights, the formal part of the Constitution, the Declaration of Rights, that there are Twenty-two sections. that Bill of Rights. And just looking at it hurriedly, I notice eight of those 22 sections, 22 rights, have to do with things that the judicial at least enforces. For instance, we have a section on the grand jury. We have a section on the due process of law. We have the section on the grand jury. We have a section on the rights of the accused. Just what we're trying to do with people that do get involved with the criminal law. And there's lots of sections on that. We have the rights of the accused, excessive punishment, habeas corpus, searches and seizures, attainders and ex post facto laws. I don't know if I ever did really understand that, and probably don't yet. Something we don't run into very often, but it's something that is in the United States Constitution, it's in our Constitution. And we have this section on civil rights and trial by jury. That's interesting in a way. Section 16 says in all cases where the amount in controversy exceeds $250, the right of trial by a jury of 12 is preserved to the same extent as it existed in common law. The legislature may provide for a verdict of not less than 3/4 of a jury on a in civil cases in courts not of record. May provide for a jury, verdict of not less than 3/4 of jury, and in courts not of record, may provide for a jury of not less than 6 or more than 12. Well, now, as a practical matter, in Superior Court, probably, let's leave out the default divorces, which, of course, are not jury cases in any case, but take everything else. I suppose that probably 3/4 of the court business is taken up with domestic relations matters in one way or another, but the other quarter, I suppose there's not 10% that are handled with a jury. And even in the Superior Court, with counsel agreeing, I suppose that there's not over 10% of that 10% that are tried by a 12-man jury. They're tried by consent with a 6-man jury. All right. I've had some experience now. I said a while ago, almost 17 years. It is almost 17 years as a trial judge. What do I see has been happening under our judicial article? Honestly, if I had it to write to again today, I wouldn't change it. I haven't found anything that is not workable. I wouldn't change it at all. Maybe I ought to review just a little bit about what the article provides. Generally, it provides that in Superior and Supreme Court, that the judges are appointed from a panel that is composed of the Chief Justice and of 6 other people, 3 lawyers, 3 laymen, a judicial council. And that council must name at least 2 people. And the governor then picks from those 2 or more people a judge. That's true of the Supreme Court, true of the Superior Court. By legislation, it's also true of the district court. You'll remember that in the Constitution it provides that there is a Supreme Court, there's a Superior Court, and all judicial power rests in those two courts, except the legislature may, if it wishes, establish other courts, not constitutional courts. And the legislature did establish other courts. They established the district judges, they established magistrates, and I think they've tried one or two other areas. Generally speaking, though, that is the way the judiciary works. Now, originally the court provided, the legislature provided, that if we found a judge who was unable or unwilling to do his duties, that we had a hearing, and it was the duty of the presiding judge to remove the judge who either wouldn't or couldn't do his work. And I believe I'm the only one that got stuck with this duty as presiding judge of the Superior Court in Anchorage. Judge Cooper became unable to carry out his duties as Superior Court judge. Physically, just wasn't able to carry out his duties. And we lived with it for a long period of time, hoping that he would get better and that nothing would have to be done, but eventually we had to do it. And we held a hearing, and I provided that Judge Cooper was no longer capable of carrying out his duties, and Judge Cooper was removed. A distasteful duty, I might say, but it had to be done. Since that time, there's been a constitutional amendment that provides how you remove a judge who is not able to carry out his duties. And that duty probably will not fall on the presiding judge anymore to the same extent it fell on me in that case. All right. How the court's been going. To begin with, the provision provided that there would be not less than, I think it was 5 Superior Court judges. Let me see if I can find.
That's right.
5 judges. All right, that was obsolete by the time statehood, by the time we had statehood. In fact, you may not remember, but we had statehood for a year and a little bit better before we set up the judiciary. But by the time we did set up the judiciary, there were 8 Superior Court judges. The Constitution provided that the legislature should have the right to set up how many judges there should be, and the legislature in the meantime had set up 8 judges. Well, at that time, we had 2 judges in Southeastern. We had 3 judges in Anchorage. We had 2 judges in Fairbanks. We had 1 judge at North, making up the 8. I embarrassed the Chief Justice here this morning because I hadn't done my homework to find out. I asked him, how many Superior judges do we have now? And he says, I think we got about 20 or 22. And he checked and he found we now have authorized 20 judges. All right, that's some proliferation over the years, isn't it? We started out with 8 in 1959, and this is now 1976, and we're up to 20. We started out with 3 Superior Court judges in Anchorage, and we now have 8, and we now have, in addition, 1 in Kenai and 1 in Kodiak, and we're going to get 1 in Bethel very shortly. Now, Bethel really, I better give an aside here. Bethel is in what used to be the 4th Division. In other words, Bethel was in the Fairbanks area. That was because in those days, Pan American was still operating and the airlines ran from Fairbanks down to Bethel and on down into the Kuskokwim area. Isn't so anymore. As I understand it, they don't have any direct service between Fairbanks and Bethel anymore, but they do have direct service between Anchorage and Bethel. So Anchorage, for some years, has been servicing Bethel. And lo and behold, now we now have a Superior Court judge going to be appointed at Bethel. Now, please keep in mind, I'm talking for myself. I'm not talking for the judiciary. And what I say, I want you to keep in mind, is that David's talking. But to my notion, there isn't any excuse whatsoever for a judge at Bethel. To be frank about it, I'm of the same opinion concerning the judge at Kodiak and concerning the judge at Kenai, or maybe I'll put a caveat on that a little bit. I saw no objection at the time we set up a judge at Kodiak to having a judge at Kodiak or at Kenai to service that part of the what used to be the 3rd Judicial Division, now the 3rd District. But so help me, I didn't see at that time any need for 2 judges outside of Anchorage. And most certainly, I don't at this time see any reason for 3 judges served from the Anchorage area outside of Anchorage. Now, the reason given, and it's a perfectly good reason, the reason given for this fragmentation of the court system is the fact that we're trying to service the bush area, the people out of the urban areas, with judicial services. And I don't want to be misunderstood, they're entitled to it. They're probably more entitled to it than we are in the urban areas, because after all, we can get along, and there's enough of us, we can make our wants and our needs known, and sometimes the people in the bush cannot. But I personally feel that we are fragmenting the court system more than we should. And I can't see what one judge at Kodiak, even servicing the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutian Island area, as the judge is now doing, as Judge Matson is now doing, even giving those people good service, I cannot see how we can keep a judge honestly busy unless we're keeping him busy to keep him busy. And I'm afraid that may be where we're going. Now, I've only been to Bethel once in my life, and that was this summer. I had the opportunity to spend a week in Bethel. There is even less excuse, in my opinion, for a Superior Court judge in Bethel than there is for a Superior Court judge service in Kodiak and the Aleutian Islands. Maybe I'm wrong. But what I could see when I was there, it just didn't appear to me that we could possibly keep the man busy, the man in Bethel. All right. Am I saying that we should bring all these people into Anchorage and service the bush from Anchorage? Honestly, I'm not clear in my own thinking as to just what the best way to service that area is. They're entitled to service. We've got to give them service. We will give them service. But what is the best way? I'm not sure in my own mind. I do know that we're going to have to be careful. At least I think so. We're going to have to be careful to see that we don't end up with one Superior Court judge in every small community that may think that it ought to happen. It costs a lot of money to support a Superior Court judge and the supporting staff. I don't think the state of Alaska should be burdened with that money. And I think that there must be, as Wally Hickel said many years ago, there must be a better way. In any case, I think that we ought to be looking for that better way. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but somebody would have to do a lot of selling to show me in my own mind that I'm wrong. One other thing, I think I probably have talked too long already, but one other thing I do want to cover. I think I see a tendency to build empires. I think I see it in our court building in Anchorage. I think I see it all over wherever the court system is operating. After all, is it Murphy's Law or whatever law is it that says wherever there's a vacuum, somebody will move in to fill the space? I don't know what law that's supposed to be, but that's about the way it works. We started out with three Superior Court judges in Anchorage. All right, the work has grown, of course it has, but it hasn't grown that much. Either we had far too few when we started, or we've got too many now. I don't know which. But it's something we ought to watch and ought to guard against. I see we have district attorneys, we have public defenders, we have court personnel. Every place we have set up a court, we've got the court supporting personnel. I say that we ought to be careful to see that we do not raise a bureaucracy that is something with which we cannot live. Seems to me that the state of Alaska in the last 20 years, no, it isn't 20 years, but since David, has really, really, really grown. And each of these people has shown a minimum need. I think we ought to be careful to see that the need is really there and to see that the bureaucracy doesn't grow too much farther than it's gone because it's far too big now. Just look at this courthouse we got down there at Anchorage there. Five floors, all of them buzzing with people. Plus the district court set up and a bunch of agencies and people in the other side of the building, the old building. I'm sure that there isn't all that much more business since we started this court system in 1959. I'm sure that there's something that we ought to look at and make sure that the bureaucracy doesn't get completely out of hand. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Davis. Justice Rabinowitz, you're in a unique position, having been in the Superior Court and then on the Supreme Court for so many years, to review how the Constitution and particularly the judiciary article has worked out in practice. What sort of disputes have come before the Supreme Court involving the judiciary article and how philosophies have evolved on it, and also to comment on the development of judicial bureaucracy that Judge Davis commented on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I think I'll direct my remarks to the students primarily. I should introduce our chairman since no one's introduced him. He has lived on public payroll. And I'll come to this point because it represents an attitude that I think is unfortunate for the state judiciary. I'll return to that in the applications we get for a judicial position. Chairman Kleinfeld distinguished himself in an academic career, now in private practice in Fairbanks, and he clerked for the Supreme Court of Alaska for 2 years, graduated from Harvard Law School. Well, I think first, when we get to the substance of this, for the students of this constitutional review, it's important to say, well, what kind of document is this that the Founding Fathers came up with? Founding Fathers of Alaska, do they make it out of whole cloth? What is unique about it? And just how is it working? First of all, the Constitution of Alaska as a document in its entirety is reflective of what happened in Philadelphia 200 years ago. It adopts the tripartite scheme of government, three branches of government, checks and balances. Now, what is unique about Alaska's judiciary article then? Well, for its time, and we're just talking about a recent era in history, it was quite innovative. And if you think that this is a dead seminar, I just direct your attention to the very intense power struggle that's taking part in New York State amongst the politicians and judicial reformers. New York has been trying for years to reform their judiciary article and judicial system, and the goals they want to achieve, and this is a major populous state in the United States, are remarkably similar to what we started out with. And they want to achieve it at this late date. They have nothing that we have. Well, what are the unique things about the article? Well, one is merit selection. I was born in Pennsylvania, grew up in New York State. Their judgeships were bought and sold. Well, what do we have here? And I think it's crucial that you remember this. We have a merit selection system, which means that you don't have to be a power in a political party. You don't have to have the backing of any particular power group in the state. If you, by your performance, through practice, clerkship, etc., scholarship, can convince our apolitical, most of the times, constitutional body, which is called the Judicial Council, which does the nomination, you have a chance at a judgeship. Now that's the distinction here. We have a judicial council which screens applicants for judgeship. Now, other than meeting certain minimal criteria as to experience, education, citizenship, any lawyer in this state is free to apply for a position that's created at Superior Court, District Court, or Supreme Court. So what have we taken out of the normal state judicial system? We've taken out the indebtedness to either political parties or power blocks to get your judgeship. In other words, this is a way of freeing the judge to call him as he sees it. He's beholden to no one, in theory. Well, is he really beholden to no one? Unlike the federal system, if you get an appointment, you're in for life, there's good behavior. We do have retention elections. Now, this whole theory of merit selection and retention elections was taken from Missouri. It's called the Missouri Plan, with its first impetus for reform came from. Now, one of the questions that we'll probably have to ask the practitioners here, and you should be asking yourself, is if this is an ideal system, does it give us better judges? And do the people, is it democratic? Is there any check on a judge performance when he comes up for retention election. You know, retention election, for those of you who are not lawyers, we don't run against anybody. There's no campaigning, essentially. And the voters merely say, do you want Kleinfeld retained for another 10 years as a Supreme Court justice or 6 years as a Superior Court or District Court judge? Well, you have to ask yourself, if we are, as Judge Davis says, the least understood branch, although we're theoretically a co-equal branch, empty courtrooms, misunderstanding of people, maybe apathy, how do you know how a judge, how do you know what I've done, say, the last 16 years in the judiciary? How do you know whether day in and day out Judge Davis's sentences are related to reality, to the factual context that comes before him? I wager that none of you in this courtroom know Judge Bucklew's sentencing patterns or Judge Davis's, or how they handle child custody matters, contract litigation, insurance litigation, litigation involving civil rights. This is one of the problems, as I see it, in our theoretical structure. That is, how do you determine who's doing what? Well, anyhow, besides this this fundamental problem as to selection and retention, another unique feature of our system is that there's tremendous power vested in the Chief Justice and the Administrative Director, because we have a unified court system with statewide or unified funding. In other words, we don't have, as Judge Davis, I think I'll have to disagree with him, we don't have little separate, like Italy was divided, little separate city-states with their own court system. We have no city courts anymore. We have no borough or city financing for any portion of our court system. This is a dream, an ideal of most states outside, that you can have a unified court system where you can put your best men in. You don't have to go begging to various fragmented political subdivisions for support. Now, another controversial area, and an area that most states are striving for and don't have in their constitution, and this is getting technical, is that rulemaking power is vested in the Supreme Court of Alaska. By rulemaking power, I mean we can govern the way cases flow through our courts. We don't have the legislature telling us, this is how you're going to run your business. I think the theory of the Founding Fathers was those who engage in this every day ought to have the power, since they have the experience and the intimacy with the bars, the litigants, the jurors, to determine how they're going to process their own business. This is another ideal or goal that most state court systems want but do not have. So here's what we have. We have apolitical or merit selection. We have a limited voice of the people in deciding who should be retained or who shouldn't, although they have an initial voice because the governor selects from two or more people and the governor is their representative who should get a judicial position. We have unification in terms of administration at the top, and we have no dependency on political subdivisions for financing. What are the problems? You know, in theory, it's a beautiful article. It has been changed, and through experience, necessitated change. As Judge Davis says, well, he sort of regrets the days that we could handcraft everything, where we knew everyone in town, we knew every defendant, every litigant. When I went on the Supreme Court in 1965, we had probably 90 appeals a year. When Andrew Kleinfeld clerked for me, he was underemployed. Today, we have at least 500 to 600 cases filed in the Supreme Court annually. I assure you, Mr. Kleinfeld would be fully employed today if he was clerking for me. It is quite a jump. Well, I think the genius of a document is that it has to be a constitutional document. It has to be a broad mandate, and it has to have flexibility in it to meet changing conditions. And the change, you know, is apparent to anyone in terms of population growth, complexity of the economy, a change from primitive crimes to more sophisticated crimes, a change from a simple, sometimes subsistence economy to a complex economy, commercial economy. Judges are going to have to know different areas of the law that they never had to deal in. And also an awakening in our rural areas. No longer can you say they're out there and we've got this urban focus. When I was a trial judge, and I'm not going to be anecdotal because I'm going to pass this over in about 2 minutes. When I was a trial judge, I made the first trip to Fort Yukon to try a case out there. And that was in 1960 as a Superior Court judge. One of the then distinguished leaders of the bar said, what in the world is he doing? He got up at the bar meeting, our local bar meeting in Fairbanks the next week. He says, what is he bringing Harvard justice to the bush and stirring up the natives? Well, I think that attitude no longer prevails. There's great economic power in the rural areas. There's a ferment and development there. And when Judge Davis says, why put a Superior Court judge in Bethel? These are full citizens of the Supreme Court, of the state of Alaska. There are 20,000 people within a radius of 15 miles of Bethel. And we have found that if you combine district court and Superior Court jurisdiction, the work is there. But that's not the point. This is a document that is drafted quite carefully and has a great deal of flexibility. But the point is, it isn't working in a vacuum. Right at the start, and Judge Davis didn't mention this, there were political complications.